The 33rd plenary meeting of the General Assembly is called to order. Before proceeding to the items on our agenda, it's my sad duty to pay tribute to the memory of the late President of the Republic of Zambia, His Excellency Michael Chirufya Sata, who passed away on Tuesday, 28th October 2014. On behalf of the General Assembly, I request the representative of Zambia to convey our condolences to the government and people of Zambia and to the bereaved family of His Excellency Michael Chirufya Sata. Now I invite representatives to stand and observe a minute of silence in tribute to the memory of His Excellency Michael Chirufya Sata. Thank you. Excellencies, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, it is with a deep personal sadness that I learnt of the President Sata's passing this week. Over the years, I had the pleasure of working with President Sata on many issues of mutual importance to our two countries. He was a remarkable man of peace whose efforts impacted not only the people of Zambia and the African continent, but indeed the entire world. The President's work ethics and his tireless devotion to the Zambian people will long be remembered, as will his legendary journey into the highest political office in Zambia. President Sata was a one of a kind, and he will be greatly missed. May his soul rest in eternal peace. I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Zambia.
Mr. President, Your Excellencies, I stand before this august house representing a nation in mourning. His Excellency Mr. Michael Chirufya Sata, President of the Republic of Zambia, passed away on the night of Tuesday, 28th October 2014 in London, UK, where he had gone for medical attention. His death comes only 4 days after the nation was awash with joy in celebrating its golden jubilee, marking 50 years of independence. Born in 1937 in Impika District in northern Zambia, the late President Sata was the fifth Republican president. He came into office in September 2011 after winning the presidential elections and unseating the Movement for Multi-Party Democracy, which had ruled Zambia for 20 years. President Sata was a prominent figure in the political history of Zambia. Before joining politics, he worked in different capacities, including the police force, the London Transport, later as a business practitioner, and eventually easing naturally into political sphere. The late president's political career began from the lower ranks of ward councillor, gradually rising to political eminence through his election as Republican president in 2011. It may be recalled that in 1991, President Sata was one of the prominent voices who left government to join the call for the reintroduction of multi-party democracy. During this historical nation reawakening, his political acumen was key in influencing the national drive for political freedom and restoration of other democratic rights. He held various portfolios thereafter, including Minister for Health, Minister for Local Government, Minister for Labor, and District Governor for Lusaka, among others. His last position before forming the Patriotic Front, that was that of a Minister Without Portfolio and National Secretary of the ruling party then. This made him the third senior most in the hierarchy of late President Frederick Chiluba's administration. Owing to his unique qualities, he found himself being assigned some of the most challenging portfolios. Rather than deter him, he pushed to achieving astounding success, which further enhanced his political standing. The late President Sata believed in improving the welfare of all Zambians, especially women and children, and his national appeal grew with time. He was the grassroots politician in the true sense of the word. His contribution to Zambia's continued peace and tranquility, as well as to consolidating the country's democratic dispensation, is unparalleled. On two occasions, when multitudes of his supporters wanted to take to the streets in the aftermath of the 2006 and 2008 general and presidential elections in dispute of the results, he appealed for calm and restraint for the sake of national unity, thereby putting national interest above self. The late president almost single-handedly led his political party, the Patriotic Front, to grow from its humble beginning to eventually dominating the Zambian political landscape. He contested presidential elections immediately after resigning from government in 2001 and subsequent elections of 2006 and the presidential by-election in 2008, before finally recording a resounding victory at the 2011 elections. In his hallmark fashion, after each election, he would immediately launch the next elections campaign, starting with a countrywide tour to thank those that had voted for him. His voice in the political opposition was thus a constant and effective threat to the incumbent governments. President Sata was well known for his brevity and candidness. He was equally humorous, generous, and exhibited a degree of humility and friendliness rarely characteristic of people with power. Mr. President, Zambia has lost an astounding political organizer who caused sleepless nights in his political opponents. He will be fondly remembered as a man of action and also a president who contributed to Zambia's economic development through massive investment in infrastructure and opened up Zambia's interconnectivity in a manner never seen before in just 3 years of his rule. The late President Michael Sata has been a key supporter of the United Nations, as its work resonated with his passion for service to his fellow man. His addresses to the high-level segments of the 67th, 68th, and 69th session can attest to this fact. On behalf of the government and the people of the Republic of Zambia, I wish to thank the President of the General Assembly, the Secretary General of the United Nations, through whom the member states are observing this commemoration, and to the entire United Nations membership for joining hands with the Zambian people at this great hour of need. I want to assure you that our nation is greatly appreciative of your actions. Let me therefore end by informing the Assembly that the transition process is now underway, and in accordance with the Zambian constitutional provisions, His Honour the Vice President of the Republic of Zambia, Dr. Guy Scott, is acting as President pending the presidential by-elections, which must be held within 90 days of the death of the incumbent. Government is gratified that the Zambian people continue to be united, and now united in grief, are looking to paying their last respects to their late president in peace and dignity. We rely on the solidarity and best wishes of our friends in the international community to overcome this national tragedy. May the soul of our dearly departed president, His Excellency Mr. Michael Chirufya Sata, rest in eternal peace. I thank you.
I thank the distinguished representative of Zambia. I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Bolivia on behalf of the Group of 77 and China.
Mr. President, Excellencies, I have the honor to speak on behalf of the Group of 77 and China to pay tribute to Mr. Michael Chirufya Sata, beloved President of the Republic of Zambia, who passed away on October 28, 2014, in London at King Edward VII Hospital. On behalf of the Group of 77 and China, I wish to express our solidarity with the Republic of Zambia and reiterate our heartfelt condolences on the death of President Sata. Mr. Sata became the fifth president of Zambia on September 23, 2011, after a popular poll. His achievements and efforts constitute an important contribution to the development and growth of the Republic of Zambia. Furthermore, the Group of 77 and China will continue to support the valuable initiatives of that country. To the people of Zambia, we know that words can give little consolation to relieve grief, but we would like to express our deep sorrow for the loss of such an important leader. I thank you.
I thank the distinguished representative of Bolivia, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Malawi on behalf of African states.
Mr. President, the African group wishes to condole the acting President of the Republic of Zambia, His Honor, Mr. Guy Scott, and the people of Zambia for the loss of one of the Africa's finest leaders, His Excellency Michael Chirufya Sata, who passed away on 20th October 2014 in London, in the United Kingdom, at the age of 77. We join the people of Zambia in this sad moment in paying our tribute to a leader who devoted his whole life to what was right for the people of his country, the African continent, and the whole world. President Sata was a man of substance and vision. During his campaign to the presidency, he carried to his people the message of peaceful coexistence among all Zambians. He also campaigned for the socio-economic development of his country, and he strived to see Zambia prosper to great heights. Mr. President, Africa will fondly remember President Sata as a fearless freedom fighter a reformer and one of the architects of the liberation struggle that led to the independence of Zambia and other African countries. We know that President Sata will be missed by those who knew him personally and officially for the ideals that he firmly believed in and for the courage he had in ensuring that his people had the basic needs they deserved and beyond. We in the African group are profoundly sorry for the loss of a true son of Zambia and Africa. He worked tirelessly to promote peace and stability, not only for his own country, Zambia, but for the whole of the African continent and beyond. In this period of sorrow, the African group wishes to urge all Zambian nationals to remain calm, united, and peaceful. May his soul rest in peace.
I thank the distinguished representative of Malawi. I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Japan on behalf of the Asia-Pacific states.
Mr. President, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I have the great honor to speak on behalf of the Asia-Pacific Group at this solemn gathering of the General Assembly to pay tribute to the memory of His Excellency, Mr. Michael Chirufuya Sata, late President of the Republic of Zambia. Mr. President, history will no doubt remember the late President Sata as a man of conviction and action. Throughout his term in office that began in 2011, the late President worked diligently to improve the lives of ordinary citizens. His strong leadership had profoundly contributed to the betterment of Zambia's society. He carried out policies that catered to pro-poor and equitable development and shed the light on the have-nots of the nation's population. In particular, the late president realized the provision of free medical services to the people and built additional 650 health posts throughout the country. In the field of education, he promoted the construction of facilities for elementary and secondary schools, thereby doubling the number of school buildings in Zambia. Furthermore, he vigorously promoted infrastructure development in rural areas. The late president also underscored the importance of realizing social justice. He established an anti-corruption commission and increased the staffs and budget for the Auditor General's office. Mr. President, he was a strong supporter of the United Nations as well. In his address to this August Assembly in September 2013, which sadly turned out to be his last appearance on this podium, he solemnly declared his belief in multilateralism and his determination to work towards international peace and development through this organization. One notable instance of his commitment to the United Nations was Zambia's active role in addressing various challenges that landlocked developing countries, so-called LLDCs, are faced with. The Zambian delegation, in its capacity as chair of the group of LLDCs, has been taking the lead in this field. His passing is undoubtedly a tremendous loss for this world body. Mr. President, in my national capacity, I would like to briefly touch upon the privileged relationship that Japan had with Zambia and its late President Sata. This year, marks the 50th anniversary of the Zambian independence. It was on the day of the closing ceremony of the Tokyo Summer Olympics held in 1964 that Northern Rhodesia became independent as Zambia. Newly founded Zambia's athletes proudly marched onto the field in Tokyo, brandishing their national flag. Japanese people were deeply impressed by their march, which symbolized a huge expectation towards their bright future. Since then, our two nations have been fostering strong and friendly relationships. Japan's Imperial Highnesses, Prince and Princess Akishino visited Zambia last July to celebrate the 50th anniversary of bilateral diplomatic relations. The late President Sata had made significant contributions in strengthening our bilateral ties. Through his visit to Japan, including his official visit in 2012, and his participation in the 5th Tokyo International Conference on African Development, TICAD 5, in 2013, he personally deepened exchanges with our people. I myself had the honor to meet with President Sata in January this year on the occasion of the African Union Summit held in Addis Ababa. It was thus with great sadness that I learned of the sudden passing of the late president. Mr. President, the world has lost a great politician. On this solemn occasion, in my capacity as president of the Asia-Pacific Group for the month of October, I wish to convey my deepest condolences to the family of the late president and to the government and people of the Republic of Zambia. It is our strong belief that Zambian people have the strength to overcome the sadness and to continue to work towards further prosperity. May his soul rest in peace. I thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished representative of Japan, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Estonia on behalf of Eastern European states.
Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, it was with great sadness that I learned of the passing of His Excellency Mr. Michael Chilofya Sata, the President of the Republic of Zambia. As Chairman of the Group of Eastern European States, please allow me, on behalf of our group, to express our deepest condolences to the people of Zambia and to the family of late President Sata with regard to this sad news. I would like to take the opportunity to pay tribute to the late president, who was a well-respected member of the international community and a committed leader of the Zambian people. History will remember President Sata as a charismatic leader whom his own nation is remembering as a passionate competitor, a true Zambian, a man of conviction and great determination. As has been noted by his friends, he was extremely dedicated about anything he had decided to achieve. Throughout his political career, he played an important role in the public life of his country and remained a vocal advocate of the Zambian people. May he rest in peace.
I thank the distinguished representative of Estonia, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Grenada on behalf of Latin America and Caribbean states.
Mr. President, representatives, on behalf of the member states of the Group of Latin America and Caribbean Countries, GRULAC, and the Permanent Mission of Grenada, I convey sincere condolences on the passing of the President Michael Chalufa Sata to the Permanent Representative of Zambia, his staff, the family of the late President, and the government and people of Zambia. Zambians to whom I have spoken said to me that the late President Michael Sata was a hard-working man for his people, his country, and Africa. Years before he became president, throughout his political life and as president, he worked with passion for the poor and the marginalized. And he was always a man of action. He was a policeman, a trade union leader, a railroad sweeper, a porter, and a president. He was a lifelong learner, graduating with a degree only in 2011. But through it all, he never lost his common touch and a passion to improve the lives of his people. He leaves a model of determination to be emulated by political leaders. In celebrating his life, it is fitting to recall the late president's celebration of the reform of the healthcare system in his country during his tenure as Minister of Health, an accomplishment worth taking note of in face of the healthcare challenges in Africa today. In the words of a poet, and I quote, "To earn the appreciation of earnest critics and endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate the beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, a redeemed social condition, to know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived, is to have succeeded." Michael Sata succeeded. This passing of the head of state of Zambia, a man of courage who died in the search for sustainable development in his country, diminishes us all. May his soul rest in peace. I thank you.
I thank the distinguished representative of Grenada, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Sweden on behalf of Western European and others.
Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, on this very solemn occasion, I have the honor to speak on behalf of the Western European and other states group. It is with profound sadness and great sorrow that we have learned of the passing of the President of the Republic of Zambia, His Excellency, Mr. Michael Chalufa Sata. We just celebrated Zambia's Golden Jubilee last week on October 24, and history will remember President Sata as a leader committed to building his country during its first 50 years of independence. We recognize his many accomplishments and his desire for the political and economic development of Zambia. Mr. President, throughout his term in office, President Sata was committed to the cause of social justice, with particular attention to the country's youth. Under his leadership, Zambia continued making great strides towards fulfilling the 8 Millennium Development Goals, particularly in primary school enrollment and the fight against child malnutrition and malaria. We now offer our profound condolences to the government and people of the Republic of Zambia, to his wife, Dr. Christine Kasebe Sata, to his family and relatives, as well as to our dear friends and colleagues of the Mission of Zambia here in New York. I thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished representative of Sweden, and I now give the floor to the United States representative as host country.
Mr. President, Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the United States of America, I would like to express my government's deep condolences on the passing of Zambian President Michael Chilufya Sata. We extend our sympathies to the president's family and the people of Zambia during this time of mourning. We honor President Sata's years of service to his country and his leadership in the Southern African region. His many accomplishments will be remembered with respect. We note that the passing of President Sata came just days after Zambia celebrated 50 years of independence, and the United States has considered itself a friend of the people of Zambia throughout this time and has recognized Zambia's strong democratic tradition. As President Obama wrote President Sata on October 21st, the U.S. government has been proud to count Zambia as a partner through Zambia's first 50 years, and we look forward to growing that partnership in the years ahead. We offer our deep condolences. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished representative of the United States. The General Assembly will now consider the report of the International Court of Justice covering the period 1st August 2013, 31st July 2014, which is contained in document A/69/4. And in connection with this item, the Assembly also has before it the report of the Secretary General on his trust fund to assist states in the settlement of disputes through International Court of Justice, which has been circulated in document A/69/337. Excellencies, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, I welcome Honorable Judge Peter Tomka, President of the International Court of Justice, to the General Assembly, who will be presenting a report on the activities of the court to this meeting. The role of the International Court of Justice in applying principles and norms of international law is essential to the promotion of rule of law, friendly relations among states, and ultimately, international peace and security. This year's report shows increased judicial activity and sustained efforts to handle proceedings more expeditiously. The 7 new cases introduced during the reporting period demonstrate that states from all regions of the world have gained strong confidence in the court and its capacity to deliver justice. It is now my honor to welcome to the United Nations headquarters His Excellency Peter Tomka, President of the International Court of Justice, and to invite him to take the floor.
Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, before presenting the report on the activities of the court, I wish to join those who have paid tribute to late President Michael Sata of Zambia and to express on behalf of the principal judicial organ of the United Nations our heartfelt sympathy and condolences to the government and people of Zambia. Mr. President, I would like to thank the General Assembly for continuing the practice of allowing the President of the International Court of Justice to present the review of the Court's judicial activities for the previous year. This practice reflects the interest in and support for the Court shown by Your Eminent Assembly. During the last 12 months, the Court has continued to fulfill its role as the forum of choice of states for the peaceful settlement of every kind of international dispute over which it has jurisdiction. As illustrated in the report that I have the honor to present to you today, the court has made every effort to meet the expectations of the parties appearing before it in a timely manner, particularly when it has been presented with requests for the indication of provisional measures. During the reporting period, the total number of contentious cases pending before the court was 13, and it now stands at 14. In four cases, the court held hearings. First, the court held hearings on three requests for provisional measures. In October 2013, in the case concerning certain activities carried out by Nicaragua in the border area, Costa Rica versus Nicaragua, joined with the case concerning the construction of a road in Costa Rica along the San Juan River, Nicaragua versus Costa Rica. In November 2013, in the case concerning construction of a road in Costa Rica along the San Juan River, and in November 2013, in January 2014, in questions relating to the seizure and detention of certain documents and data. In March 2014, the court held hearings on the merits in the case concerning the application of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, Croatia versus Serbia. The court is now deliberating that case and is currently in the process of drafting its judgment, which it plans to deliver ahead of the triennial renewal of its composition next February. During the reporting period, the court also delivered three judgments. The first in the case concerning the request for interpretation of the judgment of 15 June 1962 in the case concerning the Temple of Preah Vihear, Cambodia versus Thailand. The second in the case concerning the maritime dispute Peru versus Chile. And the third in the case concerning whaling in the Antarctic, Australia versus Japan. In addition, it made three orders on requests for the indication of provisional measures. As is traditional, I shall now report briefly on the main decisions of the court during the past year. I shall deal first with each of the three aforementioned judgments before turning to the orders made in the cases concerning certain activities carried out by Nicaragua in the border area and the construction of a road in Costa Rica along the San Juan River, and in that concerning questions relating to the seizure and detention of certain documents and data. The first judgment delivered by the court during the period under review was given on 11 November 2013 in the case concerning the request for the interpretation of the judgment of 15 June 1962 in the case concerning the Temple of Preah Vihear. The proceedings concerning interpretation were instituted on 28 April 2011 by the Kingdom of Cambodia, which requested the court to interpret the judgment delivered by the court in 1962. The court was seized following incidents between Cambodia and Thailand in the border area close to the temple. In its application, Cambodia contended that even though, and I quote, Thailand did not dispute Cambodia's sovereignty over the temple, end of quote, it nevertheless called into question the 1962 judgment in its entirety by, and I quote again, refusing Cambodia's sovereignty over the area beyond the temple as far as its vicinity. The applicant therefore asked the court to interpret its judgment of 1962, in which it had stated, in the second operative paragraph, that Thailand was under an obligation to withdraw any personnel stationed by it at a temple or in its vicinity on Cambodian territory. In its judgment rendered in November 2013, the court first considered whether it had jurisdiction and whether Cambodia's request for interpretation was admissible. That request was made pursuant to Article 60 of the Statute of the Court, which provides that in the event of dispute as to the meaning or scope of a judgment, the court shall construe it upon the request of any party. After examining whether the conditions set out in Article 60 were satisfied, the Court concluded that there was a dispute between the parties as to the meaning and scope of its 1962 judgment. It noted in this respect that the principal dispute concerned the territorial scope of the second operative paragraph, namely the territorial extent of the vicinity of the Temple of Preah Vihear. The Court considered that from the reasoning in the 1962 judgment, seen in the light of the pleadings in the original proceedings, the second operative paragraph of 1962 judgment required Thailand to withdraw from the whole of the territory of the promontory of Preah Vihear any Thai personnel stationed there. Accordingly, the Court concluded that the terms vicinity on Cambodian territory had to be construed as extending at least to the area where, at the time of the original proceedings, a Thai police detachment was found to have been stationed. The Court observed that that conclusion was confirmed by a number of other factors, and in particular, the fact that the area around the temple is located on an easily identifiable geographical feature, a promontory. To the east, south, and southwest, the promontory drops in a steep escarpment to the Cambodian plain. The parties were in agreement in 1962 that this escarpment and the land at its foot were under Cambodian sovereignty in any event. To the west and northwest, the land drops in a slope less steep than the escarpment, but nonetheless pronounced, into the valley which separates Preah Vihear from the neighboring hill of Phnom Trap, a valley which itself drops away in the south to the Cambodian plain. The Court found that the Phnom Trap lay outside the disputed area, and the 1962 judgment did not address the question whether it was located in Thai or Cambodian territory. Accordingly, the Court considered that the promontory of Preah Vihear ended at the foot of the hill of Phnom Trap, that is to say, where the ground begins to rise from the valley. In the north, it concluded that the reasoning in 1962 judgment showed that the Court considered Cambodia's territory to extend as far as the line on the map annexed to its pleadings in the original proceedings, the so-called Annex 1 map, which had been accepted by the parties. It therefore ruled that in the north, the limit of the promontory is the Annex 1 map line from a point to the northeast of the temple, where that line abuts the escarpment to a point in the northwest where the ground begins to rise from the valley at the foot of the hill of Phnom Trap. The Court then examined the relationship between the second operative paragraph and the rest of the operative part of the judgment. It considered that the territorial scope of the three operative paragraphs was the same. The finding in the first paragraph that, and I quote, the Temple of Preah Vihear is situated in territory under the sovereignty of Cambodia, end of quote, must be taken as referring, like the second and third paragraphs, to the whole of the territory of the promontory of Preah Vihear. Finally, the Court observed that the Temple of Preah Vihear is a site of religious and cultural significance for the peoples of the region and is now listed by UNESCO as a World Heritage Site. In this respect, it recalled that under Article 6 of the 1972 Convention Concerning the Protection of the World Cultural and Natural Heritage, to which both states are parties, Cambodia and Thailand must cooperate between themselves and with the international community in the protection of the site as a world heritage. In addition, each state is under an obligation not to, quote, take any deliberate measures which might damage directly or indirectly such heritage, end of quote. In the context of these obligations, the Court emphasized the importance of ensuring access to the temple from the Cambodian plain. In the operative part of its judgment, the court found that Cambodia had sovereignty over the whole territory of the promontory of Preah Vihear, as previously defined, and that in consequence, Thailand was under an obligation to withdraw from that territory the Thai military or police forces or other guards or keepers that were stationed there. Mr. President, also during the review period on 27 January 2014, the court handed down a second judgment on delimitation of the boundary between the maritime zones of Peru and Chile in the Pacific Ocean. Peru argued that no agreed maritime boundary existed between itself and Chile and asked the court to draw a boundary line using the equidistance method in order to achieve an equitable result. Chile, on the other hand, contended that it was not for the court to draw a boundary line since an international maritime boundary agreed between the parties already existed. It followed, according to Chile, the parallel of latitude passing through the starting point of the Peru-Chile land boundary and extended to a minimum of 200 nautical miles. And I can refer you to the map which has been distributed. In order to resolve the dispute, the court first sought to ascertain whether, as Chile claimed, an agreed maritime boundary already existed. For that purpose, the court examined various instruments submitted to it by the parties, and in particular the 1947 proclamations, whereby Peru and Chile had each unilaterally proclaimed certain maritime rights extending 200 nautical miles from their respective coasts, as well as the 1952 Santiago Declaration in which Chile, Ecuador, and Peru, and I quote, proclaimed as a norm of their international maritime policy that they each possessed exclusive sovereignty and jurisdiction of the sea along the coast of their respective countries to a minimum distance of 200 nautical miles from these coasts, end of quote. The court found, however, that none of these instruments established a maritime boundary between Peru and Chile. The court then proceeded to examine a series of subsequent agreements and arrangements between Peru, Chile, and Ecuador. In particular, it analyzed a document dating from 1954, the Special Maritime Frontier Zone Agreement, which established a zone of tolerance starting at a distance of 12 nautical miles from the coast, of 10 nautical miles on either side of the parallel which constitutes the maritime boundary, and that was the quote. The court found that the terms of that instrument acknowledged in a binding international agreement that the maritime boundary already existed. The court noted, however, that the text did not indicate when and by what means that boundary had been agreed upon. The court therefore concluded that the parties' express acknowledgement of the existence of a maritime boundary could only reflect a tacit agreement which they had reached earlier, and that this had been cemented by the 1954 Special Maritime Frontier Zone Agreement. The court observed, however, that that agreement gave no indication of the nature of the maritime boundary, nor did it indicate its extent, although its terms made it clear that the maritime boundary extended beyond 12 nautical miles from the coast. In light of that finding, the court then addressed the question of the nature of the agreed maritime boundary, pointing out that the tacit agreement between the parties must be understood in the context of the 1947 proclamations and the 1952 Santiago Declaration, which expressed claims to the seabed and to the waters about the seabed and their resources, with no distinction having been drawn by the parties between these spaces. The court concluded that the maritime boundary was an all-purpose one.
the court then sought to determine the extent of the agreed maritime boundary. It began by examining the practice of the parties in the early and mid-1950s, starting with fishing potential and activity. The court noted that the information referred to by the parties showed that the species which were being taken in the early 50s were generally to be found within a range of 60 nautical miles from the coast. While recalling that, given the maritime boundary's all-purpose nature, evidence concerning fisheries activities could not in itself be determinative of its extent, the court believed that those activities appeared to indicate that at the time when the parties acknowledged the existence of an agreed maritime boundary between them, they were unlikely to have considered that it extended all the way to the 200 nautical mile limit. The court then moved on the broader context and examined the development of the law of the sea at the start of the 1950s. In particular, it observed that claims to a maritime zone of at least 200 nautical miles, such as those made by the parties in the 1952 Santiago Declaration, did not correspond to the international law of the period. On the basis of parties' fishing activities at that time, the relevant practice of other states and the work of the International Law Commission on the Law of the Sea, the court considered that the evidence at its disposal did not allow it to conclude that the agreed maritime boundary along the parallel extended beyond 80 nautical miles from its starting point. In light of that tentative conclusion, the court examined further elements of practice, for the most part subsequent to 1954, but concluded that they did not lead it to change its position. The court then turned to the question of the starting point of the agreed maritime boundary. After paying particular attention to documents having led to the conclusion of arrangements whereby in 1968-69 the parties decided to construct lighthouses, and I quote, to materialize the parallel of maritime frontier originating at the first boundary marker along the land frontier, the court concluded that the starting point of the maritime boundary between the parties was located in the intersection of the low water line with the parallel of latitude passing through boundary marker number one. The court next proceeded to its determination of the course of the maritime boundary from the endpoint of the agreed line. For that purpose, it applied its usual methods, as explained in detail in its 2009 judgment in the case concerning maritime delimitation in the Black Sea, Romania versus Ukraine. The court concluded that the maritime boundary between the parties starts at the intersection of the parallel of latitude passing through boundary marker number one with the low water line and extends for 80 nautical miles along that parallel of latitude to point A. From this point, the maritime boundary runs along the equidistance line to point B and then along the 200 nautical mile limit measure from the Chilean baseline to point C. Before concluding my summary of this case, I would draw your attention to Peru's second submission, in which it requested the court to adjudge and declare that beyond the point where the common maritime boundary ended, it was entitled to exercise sovereign rights over a maritime area lying out to a distance of 200 nautical miles from its baselines. This claim was in relation to the area in a darker shade of blue in sketch map number two, which I understand has been circulated. The court held, however, that since it had already concluded that the agreed boundary ended at 80 nautical miles from the coast, and that it had further decided that beyond that point it would delimit the parties' maritime entitlements by drawing an equidistance line, the second submission by Peru had become moot. The court therefore did not rule on it. In light of the particular circumstances of the case, The court determined the course of the maritime boundary between the parties without specifying its precise geographical coordinates. It recalled that the parties had not requested it to do so in their final submissions. The court accordingly invited Peru and Chile to determine those coordinates in accordance with the judgment in a spirit of good neighborliness, and the two states indeed proceeded to do so just a few months after the court handed its decision. It is thus worth emphasizing that within 2 months from the delivery of the judgment, the two parties and the governments reached a joint agreement on the precise geographical coordinates of their maritime boundary on the basis of the description set out in the court's judgment. Monsieur le Président.
Mr. President, the courts issued a third judgment, the 31st of March 2014, in the case concerning whaling in the Antarctic between Australia and Japan, with New Zealand intervening under Article 2, Para 2 of Article 63 of the statute. The proceedings had been instituted on the 31st of May 2010 by Australia, who accused Japan of the, and I quote, continued pursuit of a large-scale program of whaling under the second phase of its Japanese whale research program under special permit in the Antarctic, JARPA 2, in breach of obligations assumed by Japan under the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling, as well as its other international obligations for the preservation of marine mammals and the marine environment. End of quote. The court began by addressing the issue of its jurisdiction, which Japan contested on the ground that the dispute fell within the scope of a reservation in Australia's declaration of acceptance of the court's compulsory jurisdiction. In the court's view, however, that reservation applied only where there was a dispute between the parties over maritime delimitation, which was not the case here. The court accordingly concluded that Japan's objection to jurisdiction could not be upheld. The court then turned to the core of the case, the interpretation and application of Article 8 of the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling, of which the relevant part of Para 1 reads as follows, and I quote, notwithstanding anything contained in this convention, any contracting government may grant to any of its nationals a special permit authorizing that national to kill, take, and treat whales for purposes of scientific research, subject to such restrictions as to number and subject to such other conditions as the contracting government thinks fit. End of quote. In regard to the interpretation of that provision, the court began by observing that, although Article 8 gave discretion to a state party to the convention to reject a request for a special permit or to specify the conditions for the grant of such a permit, the question whether the killing, taking, and treatment of whales pursuant to a requested special permit was for purposes of scientific research could not depend simply on that state's perception. The court then discussed the meaning of the phrase, quote, for purposes of scientific research, end of quote, in that article, concluding that the two elements of that phrase were cumulative. As a result, even if a whaling program involved scientific research, the killing, taking, and treating of whales pursuant to such a program did not fall within Article 8 unless those activities were for purposes of scientific research. Regarding the application of Para 1 of Article 8, the court found that JARPA 2 could generally be characterized as a scientific research program. The court then sought to ascertain whether the use of lethal methods was for purposes of scientific research, and to that end, it considered whether the elements of the program's design and implementation were reasonable in relation to its stated scientific objectives. In this connection, the court inter alia examined the following elements: decisions regarding the use of lethal weapon methods, the scale of the program's use of lethal sampling, the methodology used to select sample sizes, a comparison of the target sample sizes, and the actual take, the time frame associated with a program, the program's scientific output, and the degree to which the program coordinated its activities with related research projects. From its examination, the court concluded that while JARPA 2, taken as a whole, involved activities that could broadly be characterized as scientific research, and I quote, the evidence did not establish that the program's design and implementation were reasonable in relation to achieving its stated objectives. The court concluded that the special permits granted by Japan for the killing, taking, and treating of whales in connection with JARPA 2 were not, and I quote, for purposes of scientific research, end of quote, pursuant to Article 8, Para 1 of the Convention. The court next turned to the implications of that conclusion in light of Australia's contention that Japan had breached several provisions of the schedule appended to the Convention. In the view of the court, despite differences in wording, all whaling activities which did not fall within the terms of Article 8 of the Convention, with the exception of Aboriginal subsistence whaling, were covered by three specific provisions of the schedule. The court accordingly concluded that Japan had breached, one, the moratorium on commercial whaling for each of the years in which it had set catch limits above zero for minke whales, fin whales, and humpback whales under JARPA 2. Two, the factory ship moratorium for each of the seasons during which fin whales were taken, killed, and treated under JARPA 2. And three, the ban on commercial whaling in the Southern Ocean Sanctuary for each of the JARPA 2 seasons during which fin whales had been taken. However, the court held that, contrary to what Australia had claimed, Japan had met the requirements of a further provision of the schedule, whereby every contracting government must make proposed permits available to the International Whaling Commission in sufficient time to permit review and comment by the scientific committee. In light of its findings, the court then addressed the issue of remedies. The court noted that JARPA 2 was an ongoing program and that measures going beyond declaratory relief were warranted. It therefore ordered Japan to revoke any extant authorization, permit, or license to kill, take, or treat whales in relation to JARPA 2, and to refrain from granting any further permits under Article 8, Para 1 of the Convention in pursuance of that program, JARPA 2. On the other hand, the court saw no need to order the additional remedy requested by Australia, which would require Japan to refrain from authorizing or implementing any special permit whaling, which was not for purposes of scientific research within the meaning of Article 8. In the court's view, that obligation already applied to all state parties. At this point, I should also like to take the opportunity to draw the Assembly's attention to the fact that the court has made increasing use of the deliberation procedure provided for in Article 1 of the resolution concerning the internal judicial practice of the court. In particular, its first paragraph, which provides that after the termination of the written proceedings, before the beginning of the oral proceedings, a deliberation is held at which the judges exchange views concerning the case and bring to the notice of the court any point in regard to which they consider it may be necessary to call for explanations during the course of the oral proceedings. This deliberation effectively enables the court to identify any issue on which it would like further explanation or clarification during the hearings on the substance of the case. Thus, once it has completed its deliberation, the court communicates its queries to the parties with a view to directing their oral presentations towards providing the additional information needed by the court at the hearings. It is a procedure that is particularly useful in cases with a high scientific content or where the factual background is a particularly complex one. The court did indeed hold such a deliberation in the whaling case, as well as in the case between Ecuador and Colombia concerning aerial herbicide spraying, which was settled by the parties before the opening of the hearings on the merits. Mr. President, as I've already said, during the reporting period, the court also handed down three orders, which I will briefly present in chronological order. The first of them was issued on the 22nd of November 2013 in the case concerning certain activities carried out by Nicaragua in the border area. That decision followed a request for the indication of new provisional measures submitted on in September 2013 by Costa Rica, protesting against Nicaragua's construction of two new canals, caños, in the disputed territory, as defined by the court in an order for the indication of provisional measures of the 8th of March 2011, namely the northern part of Isla Portillos, that is to say the area of wetland of some 3 square kilometers between the right bank of the disputed Caño, the right bank of the San Juan River, up to its mouth at the Caribbean Sea and the Harbor Head Lagoon. In its order of the 22nd of November 2013, the court held that there was sufficient evidence before it for it to conclude that given the length, width, and location of a trench dug close to the larger of the two new canals, the Eastern Caño, there was a real risk of its reaching the Caribbean Sea as a result of either natural or human action or of a combination of the two. This could cause the San Juan River to change its course with serious consequences for the rights claimed by Costa Rica in the case. The court thus decided not only to reiterate the provisional measures indicated by it in its order of the 8th of March 2011, but also to order new measures. It stated that Nicaragua must refrain from any dredging and other activities in the disputed territory, and must in particular refrain from work of any kind on the two new caños and fill in the trench on the beach north of the eastern caños. A few weeks later, on the 13th of December 2013, the court handed down an order in the case concerning the construction of a road in Costa Rica along the San Juan River. In its request for the indication of provisional measures, Nicaragua stated that it was seeking to protect certain rights which it claimed were threatened by roadworks being carried out by Costa Rica, in particular the resultant transboundary movement of sediment and other debris. The court, however, found that the circumstances, as they then presented themselves to it, were not such as to require the exercise of its power to indicate provisional measures. In particular, the court considered that Nicaragua had not established that the construction works had led to a substantial increase in the sediment load in the river and had not presented evidence as to any long-term effect on the river by aggradations of the river channel allegedly caused by additional sediment from the construction of the road. Nor had the applicant explained how certain species in the river's wetlands could be endangered by the road works, or identified with precision which species were likely to be affected. Lastly, the court handed down a third order for the indication of provisional measures in the case concerning questions relating to the seizure and detention of certain documents and data, Timor-Leste versus Australia. That decision followed a request submitted on the 17th of December 2013 by Timor-Leste on account of the seizure on the 3rd of December 2013 and subsequent detention by agents of Australia of documents, data, and other property which belongs to Timor-Leste and or which Timor-Leste has the right to protect under international law. Timor-Leste claimed that the items seized included inter alia documents, data, and correspondence between Timor-Leste and its legal advisors relating to the pending arbitration under the Timor Sea Treaty of the 20th of May 2012 between Timor-Leste and Australia. In its decision of the 3rd of March 2014, the court took the view that if Australia failed to immediately safeguard the confidentiality of the materials seized by its agents on the 3rd of December 2013, the right of Timor-Leste to conduct arbitral proceedings and negotiations without interference could suffer irreparable harm. The court noted, however, that the Attorney General of Australia had given a written undertaking on the 21st of January 2014, which included an assurance that the seized material would not be made available to any part of the Australian government for any purpose in connection with the exploitation of resources in the Timor Sea or related negotiations, or in connection with the conduct of the current case before the court of the proceedings of the Timor Sea Treaty Tribunal. Nevertheless, after taking cognizance of the fact that in certain circumstances involving national security, the government of Australia envisaged the possibility of making use of the seized material, the court took the view that while the written undertaking made a significant contribution towards mitigating the imminent risk of irreparable prejudice to Timor-Leste's rights caused by the seizure of the above-mentioned material, it did not remove this risk entirely. The court accordingly concluded that the conditions required by its statute for it to indicate provisional measures had been met. Furthermore, on the 3rd of September last, the court decided to accept a joint request from the parties for the oral proceedings between Timor-Leste and Australia to be postponed. Those proceedings had been due to open on Wednesday, 17th of September 2014, and to close on Wednesday, 24th of September 2014. Having recalled the principal decisions handed down by the International Court of Justice in the course of the past year, I now come to the new cases submitted to it. In addition to the proceedings between Timor-Leste and Australia commenced on the 17th of December 2013, which I have just discussed, the court had on the 16th of September 2013 received an application from Nicaragua instituting proceedings against Colombia in which it requested the court, one, to determine the precise course of the maritime boundary between Nicaragua and Colombia and the areas of the continental shelf which appertain to each of them beyond the boundaries determined by the court in its judgment of the 19th of November 2012, and two, to state, and I quote, the principles and rules of international law that determine the rights and duties of the two states in relation to the area of overlapping continental shelf claims and the use of its resources, pending the delimitation of the maritime boundary between them beyond 200 nautical miles from Nicaragua's coast, end of quote. In November 2013, the court was seized of further proceedings by Nicaragua against Colombia in a dispute concerning, and I quote, violations of Nicaragua's sovereign rights of maritime zones declared by the court's judgment of the 19th of November 2012 and the threat of the use of force by Colombia in order to implement these violations, end of quote. Next, on 25th of February 2014, the court was seized of a dispute between Costa Rica and Nicaragua concerning maritime delimitation between the two countries in the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean. It is, moreover, noteworthy that this was the first time in the court's history that it had been asked to carry out a maritime delimitation between two states on either side of their respective mainland territories, delimitation being requested in both the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean in this specific case. Then on the 24th of April 2014, the Marshall Islands filed 9 applications with the court registry in which it accused 9 states of failing to perform their obligations with respect to nuclear disarmament and cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date. The applications filed against India, Pakistan, and the United Kingdom were entered on the court's general list, since those states have accepted the court's compulsory jurisdiction under Article 36, Para 2 of the statute. However, in the case of the 6 other applications against, in alphabetical order, China, the U.S., the Russian Federation, France, Israel, and DPRK, that was not possible. In respect of each of these applications, the Republic of the Marshall Islands stated that it sought, in accordance with Article 38, Para 5 of the Rules of Court, to base the court's jurisdiction on the consent of the state concerned under the doctrine of forum prorogatum. Without that consent, none of the applications could be entered on the forums on the court's list. Finally, on the 28th of August last, the Federal Republic of Somalia instituted proceedings against the Republic of Kenya with regard to a dispute concerning maritime delimitation in the Indian Ocean. Specifically, Somalia claims that the two states disagree on the course of their common maritime boundary and requests the court to determine on the basis of international law the complete course of the single maritime boundary dividing all the maritime areas appertaining to Kenya and the Indian Ocean, including in the continental shelf beyond 200 nautical miles. It should be noted that both states have filed a declaration accepting the court's compulsory jurisdiction under Article 36, Paragraph 2 of its statute. This thus brings to 7 the number of new cases submitted during the period under review, and to 14 the total number of cases currently on the court's docket.
À ce jour, au rôle de la cour. Monsieur le Président.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, as I have just shown, the court always strives to ensure that the disputes submitted to it are settled promptly in order to reduce its judicial backlog or even eliminate it entirely. Hearings have been held and deliberations are underway in every case on the court's general list in which the written procedure has closed. The court is thus committed to fulfilling its high judicial mission impartially and effectively, relying on the cooperation of the parties to the disputes brought before it so as to resolve them in a timely manner. By way of example, I need only remind you that the court had made all the necessary preparations for public hearings to be held this September in the case concerning questions relating to the seizure and detention of certain documents and data. It was only after receiving a joint request from the parties to postpone the hearings that it decided to adjourn the proceedings. The court has also continued its extrajudicial activities this past year, notably the organization of a conference to celebrate the centenary of the Peace Palace on 23 September 2013. That conference, which centered on the theme of the ICJ in the service of peace and justice, gave the court the opportunity to welcome prominent figures and to present speakers of the highest quality at the conference's roundtables. It was a very full but well-balanced program, encouraging speakers and audience alike not only to focus on the past and present of international justice, but also to reflect on the future and the challenges that lie ahead, particularly for the court. I'm delighted to inform this eminent assembly that in July of this year, a collective work entitled Enhancing the Rule of Law Through the International Court of Justice was published, an outcome of the conference held to mark the centenary of the Peace Palace. Mr. President, Excellences, ladies and gentlemen, by way of conclusion, I should like to recall that the court must do its utmost to serve the noble purposes and goals of the United Nations with modest resources, bearing in mind that member states awarded less than 1% of the organization's regular budget. Nevertheless, I hope that I have shown that the recent contributions of the court are not to be measured in terms of its financial resources, but against the great progress made by it in the advancement of international justice and the peaceful settlement of disputes between states. I would like, however, to draw attention to the importance of the role of member states in the composition of the court. A great responsibility is placed on member states, for it is they who are called upon to choose and elect the members of the court who will be tasked with carrying out a high and noble judicial mission. Thus, to a large extent, the quality of the principal judicial organ of the United Nations is dependent on the contribution of member states in this respect. In a similar vein, I would like to take this opportunity to remind your eminent assembly that despite various appeals and the adoption of texts by the General Assembly, the number of states having made a declaration recognizing the compulsory jurisdiction of the court under Article 36, paragraph 2 of its statute, has remained at 70 during the period under review. It is to be hoped that the statements made by certain states expressing a desire to recognize the jurisdiction of the principal judicial organ of the United Nations and the documents adopted to the same end will give rise to wider recognition of the court's jurisdiction within the international community in the form of declarations under Article 36, paragraph 2. I believe that as distinguished diplomats working specifically within the community of nations, you are in a privileged position to promote this ideal among the governments whom you represent in this assembly. I therefore reiterate my invitation to you to seek to encourage recourse to the court for the settlement of disputes, as well as increased recognition of its compulsory jurisdiction as a means of achieving peaceful resolutions to international conflicts and more harmonious interstate relations. I would like to thank the delegations of Uruguay, Netherlands, Switzerland, Lithuania, Japan, and Botswana for having taken the initiative to prepare a manual for the acceptance of the jurisdiction of the court, which will be published in the five languages, says the speaker. I welcome the publication of this manual, which will be very useful. I would like to thank you for this opportunity to address you today. May I wish you every success for the 69th session of the Assembly. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
I thank the President of the International Court of Justice. Now I give the floor to the Islamic Republic of Iran on behalf of the Non-Aligned Movement.
Thank you, Mr. President. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Mr. President, I have the honor to deliver this statement on behalf of the Non-Aligned Movement. The Non-Aligned Movement attaches great importance to Agenda Item 70, entitled Report of the International Court of Justice, and takes note of the report contained in Document A/69/4 regarding the activities of the court between the 1st of August 2013 to 31st of July 2014, as requested by the decision of the Assembly last year. I would also like to thank the President of the International Court of Justice for his presentation of the report to the Assembly today. Mr. President, the Non-Aligned Movement reaffirms and underscores its principal position concerning peaceful settlement of disputes and non-use or threat of use of force. The International Court of Justice has a significant role in promoting and encouraging the settlement of international disputes by peaceful means, as reflected in the United Nations Charter, and in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not endangered. The movement endeavors to generate further progress to achieve full respect for international law, and in this regard commends the role of ICJ in promoting the peaceful settlement of international disputes in accordance with the relevant provisions of the UN Charter and the Statute of the Court, in particular Articles 33 and 94 of the Charter. In regard to advisory opinions of the Court, noting the fact that the Security Council has not sought any advisory opinion from the Court since 1970, the NAM urges the Security Council to make greater use of the ICJ, the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, as a source of advisory opinions and interpretation of relevant norms of international law and on controversial issues. It further requests the Council to use the Court as a source of interpreting relevant international law, and also urges the Council to consider its decisions being reviewed by the Court, bearing in mind the need to ensure their adherence to the UN Charter and international law. The movement also invites the General Assembly, other organs of the United Nations, and the specialized agency duly authorized to request advisory opinions of the International Court of Justice on legal questions arising within the scope of their activities. The Non-Aligned Movement reaffirmed the importance of the unanimous ICJ advisory opinion issued on 8 July 1996 on the legality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons. On this, the ICJ concluded that there exists an obligation to pursue in good faith and bring to a conclusion negotiations leading to nuclear disarmament in all aspects under strict and effective international control. Mr. President, the Non-Aligned Movement continues to call on Israel, the occupying power to fully respect the 9 July 2004 ICJ advisory opinion entitled Legal Consequences of the Construction of a Wall in the Occupied Palestinian Territory, and calls upon all states to respect and ensure respect of the provisions therein for the realization of the end of Israeli occupation that began in 1967 and the independence of the State of Palestine with East Jerusalem at its capital. I thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished representative of Iran, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of South Africa on behalf of African states.
Mr. President, my delegation has the honor to deliver this statement on behalf of the African group. At the outset, the Africa group would like to thank the President of the International Court of Justice, Judge Peter Tomka, for his presentation and also for the report. The African group continues to consider the International Court of Justice to be the preeminent mechanism for the peaceful settlement of disputes at an international level. It should be kept in mind that the court, as a court of justice, and moreover, the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, occupies a special position. Everything the World Court does is aimed at promoting the rule of law. The World Court hands down judgments and gives advisory opinions in accordance with its statute, which is an integral part of the Charter of the United Nations, and thus contributes to promoting and clarifying international law. The African group welcomes the reaffirmed confidence that states have shown in its ability to resolve these disputes. In particular, we are pleased to see that the states continue to refer disputes to the ICJ. The number of cases currently pending on the ICJ docket is a reflection of the esteem with which the states hold the ICJ. Mr. President, notwithstanding the proliferation of international judicial settlement of disputes mechanisms on specialized original basis, the ICJ continues to attract a wide range of cases covering many areas. The list of cases before the court include cases pertaining to demarcation of boundaries, such as Peru versus Chile case. Mr. President, the Africa group appreciates the fact that the court set itself a particular demanding schedule of hearings and deliberations in order that it may consider several cases at the same time and deal as promptly as possible with incidental proceedings, which are tending to grow in numbers, including requests for the indication of preliminary and provisional measures. In this regard, on the 3rd of March 2014, the ICJ issued its order on the request for the indication of provisional measures submitted by Timor-Leste in December 2013 in the case concerning questions relating to the seizure and detention of certain documents and data. That's Timor-Leste versus Australia. The court found that it had prima facie jurisdiction to rule on the merits of the case in light of the declarations made by both parties in terms of Article 35/2 of the ICJ statute. The court also found that there was a link between the rights claimed and the provisional measures that were requested by Timor-Leste. Such measures were aimed at preventing Australia's further access to seized material. The court concluded that the conditions required that the ICJ statute had been met for it to indicate provisional measures because there was still a risk of irreparable prejudice. Mr. President, the African group is of the view that the Australia versus Japan case contributes to the body of law governing and environment and the law governing the environment, particularly in respect of the law of the sea. Australia commenced the proceedings on the 31st May 2010, on 31st March 2014. The ICJ delivered its judgment, and as far as the court's jurisdiction was concerned, the court found that since there was no maritime delimitation dispute between the parties in the Antarctic Ocean, and since the current dispute was only about the compatibility or not of Japan's whaling activities with its obligations under the convention, it concluded that Japan's objection to the court's jurisdiction could not be upheld. The court further found that Japanese whale research program under special permit in the Antarctic involved activities that could broadly be characterized as scientific research, but that the evidence does not establish that the program's design and implementation are reasonable in relation to achieving its stated objectives. To this end, the court therefore concluded that the special permits granted by Japan for the killing, taking, and treating of whales in connection with Japanese whale research program under special permit in the Antarctic were not for purposes of scientific research. Pursuant to Article 8, Paragraph 1 of the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling. Mr. President, an interesting procedural development was that by an order of 6 February 2013, the court authorized New Zealand to intervene in the whaling of the Antarctica, that is Australia versus Japan case. As such, on 20 November 2012, New Zealand filed in the registry a declaration of intervention in the case in order to avail itself of the right of intervention conferred by Article 63 of the Statute of the Court. New Zealand relied on its status as a party to the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling. It contended that as a party to the convention, it has direct interest in the construction that might be placed upon the convention by the court in its decisions in these proceedings. New Zealand underlined in its declaration that it did not seek to be a party to the proceedings and confirmed that by availing itself of its right to intervene, it accepted that the construction given by the judgment in the case would be equally binding upon it. Mr. President, the importance of advisory opinions on legal questions referred to the International Court of Justice cannot be overstated in the pursuit of peaceful settlement of disputes in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations. It is therefore rather disappointing that during the period under review, no requests for advisory opinions were made. I thank you for your attention.
I thank the distinguished representative of South Africa, and now I give the floor to the distinguished representative of Canada.
Thank you, Mr. President. On behalf of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, I would like to thank the President of the International Court of Justice, Judge Tomka, for his report on the work of the Court over the past year. As countries that firmly believe in the rule of law, Cairns have always been strong supporters of the International Court of Justice. We have tremendous respect for the work of the Court and for the quality and dedication of its judges. Once again, the Court has seen a sustained caseload, demonstrating its vital position in the peaceful resolution of disputes. The 13 cases currently before the court come from around the world and represent a diversity of subject matter. Cairns welcomes this willingness of states to turn to the court for the peaceful settlement of their disputes. Our confidence in the court is reflected in our acceptance of the court's compulsory jurisdiction. Cairns believes that wider acceptance of the compulsory jurisdiction would enable the court to fulfill its role more effectively. by reducing jurisdictional issues and thus allowing the court to focus more of its attention on the substance of disputes. In line with General Assembly Resolution 68116, we encourage member states that have not yet done so to accept the court's compulsory jurisdiction. Monsieur le Président.
Mr. President. On the 6th of November, the members of the General Assembly and Security Council will vote to fill 5 judicial vacancies within the courts. The Cannes Group unreservedly endorses the candidature of Professor James Crawford for one of the 2 vacancies in the Western European and Others Group. Professor Crawford is a distinguished international lawyer who would be a valuable addition to the courts. He received an impressive 27 nominations from national groups of the Permanent Court of Arbitration, a telling indication of the esteem in which he's held by the international legal fraternity. We encourage all members of the United Nations to support Professor Crawford. Mr. President, we expect that the work program of the court in the year ahead will remain full as states continue to affirm their confidence in the court. Cannes looks forward to the International Court of Justice continuing to play its important role in the peaceful settlement of international disputes. Thank you very much.
I thank the distinguished representative of Canada, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Switzerland.
Monsieur le
Mr. President, over the last 20 years, the activities of the International Court of Justice have grown considerably. A growing number of states recognize the practical and effective means the court offers for the peaceful settlement of disputes. Indeed, because of its unique mandate, its universal character, authority, and the finality of its decisions, as well as the consensual nature of its jurisdiction, the court constitutes an ideal framework for the peaceful settlement of disputes between states. In order to strengthen this momentum and to encourage even more states to recognize the court's jurisdiction, Switzerland and the Netherlands together on the 24th of September 2012, during the high-level meeting of the 67th session of the General Assembly of the Rule of Law, draw up with the Secretariat a practical guide to underline the court's benefits and to explain the various means available to recognize its jurisdiction. Then the UK, Uruguay, Lithuania, Japan, and Botswana subsequently joined this project. Since then, the practical guide has been completed, and it was sent this week to all permanent missions to the UN in New York. Mr. President, states have 3 possibilities to recognize the court's jurisdiction. 1, unilaterally accept its jurisdiction, 2, accept its jurisdiction by treaty, or 3, refer a specific dispute to the court by compromise. These 3 options are explained in detail in the brochure. Specific examples are given in the form of model declarations, articles, and compromise clauses that can be adopted and adapted by states as they see fit. The guide has a practical purpose. It is mainly addressed to states and can, for example, be used by their diplomats or any member of a delegation negotiating international treaties. We hope it will help to remove certain technical obstacles to the recognition of the court's jurisdiction. Mr. President, let us hope that this guide will contribute to further strengthening the court's importance and its contribution to a more just and peaceful international order. Thank you very much.
I thank the distinguished representative of Switzerland, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Cuba.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, Cuba aligns itself with a statement made by the Islamic Republic of Iran on behalf of the non-aligned movement. The Republic of Cuba is grateful for the presentation of this useful document, A69, for the report of the ICJ. We also wish to express before this assembly our commitment to the strict compliance with international law and the peaceful settlement of international disputes. Mr. President, my delegation recognizes the work of the ICJ. Its advisory opinions and decisions have been of prime importance, not just for the cases submitted for its consideration, but also for the development of international law. The volume of cases presented before the ICJ, many of which involve countries of Latin America and the Caribbean, is testament to the importance of the ICJ in the peaceful settlement of disputes. The Republic of Cuba advocates the peaceful settlement of disputes internationally pursuant to Article 36, paragraph 2 of the Charter and in line with the statute of the court. We regret that there was one decision that was involved the violation of the Charter, which requires that all members of the UN should abide by the ICJ decisions in all disputes brought before it. And in this regard, the Republic of Cuba observes with concern that the effectiveness of the court's decisions can be rightly criticized when some countries obviously flout such decision. Although most countries abide by the rulings of the court and the requirements that the UN system be used to enforce these decisions, we have noted that there is a lack of perfection in the enforcement mechanisms. And evidence shows that there's a need to reform the United Nations system so that we can give more guarantees to developing countries when faced with developed countries in when it comes to enforcing ICJ judgments. We want to see a critical balance achieved by the court in terms of ensuring that its judgments are enforced by the UN system. Mr. President, we have seen many important cases brought before the ICJ, and Cuba gives great importance to the advisory opinions issued by the court unanimously, and in 1996 there was one on the legality of the threat of the use of nuclear weapons. And in this decision, the ICJ saw that there was a need to conclude negotiations with a view to nuclear disarmament under internationally strict monitoring. And in along these lines, as we have said in this room before, Cuba urges compliance with the advisory opinion of 1996 with respect to building a wall in occupied Palestinian territory, and we call on all states to abide by the provisions of the court in this important decision. Mr. President, Cuba attaches great importance to allocating the necessary budgetary resources to ensure that the ICJ can properly discharge its functions and ensure that the conflicts brought before it are peacefully settled. We want to see the timely provision of these resources for the ICJ. We would like to thank the court for the publications made available to states governments and for the online resources, which are very useful for the study of international law. Basically, these are used mostly by developing countries, many of which lack access to updated information on international law because of the obsolete blockade against Cuba. Cuba has a peaceful calling as part of the international community, and we wish to comply with international law, and we have always faithfully discharged our international obligations under the treaties to which we are party. We'd like to take this opportunity to reiterate our commitment to peace. And the recent events have shown clearly that there's an important need to have the ICJ function as the international body to peacefully settle disputes, which are very important to the international community. Many thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank the distinguished representative of Cuba, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Romania.
Mr. President, at the outset, let me thank President Tomka for the comprehensive report on the work of the court, which allowed us to have a useful insight to the activity of the court during the judicial year 2013-2014. States submitting their disputes to the jurisdiction of the court expect the main judicial organ of the United Nations to reach a decision after a very careful assessment of the relevant laws and facts. These expectations were fully met in the case of judgments delivered by the court during the period under review. We can say that its activity has increased in scope and degree of complexity, and we commend the court for its tremendous work. The current docket bears witness to the consolidated trust placed by the states in the ICJ. My country is a strong supporter of the court and is committed to the settlement of all disputes in accordance with international law. Romania has been significantly involved with the work of the court in the past. An already known example is the application submitted in connection to the delimitation of the maritime spaces between Romania and Ukraine in the Black Sea. On February 3rd this year, an event marking 5 years since the delivery of the judgment in this case was organized in Bucharest and benefited from the presence of Judge Keith alongside several other leading personalities in the field of international law. Romania intends to continue and strengthen its engagement with the court. In this respect, let me briefly present the endeavors undertaken so far as regards the possible acceptance by Romania of the compulsory jurisdiction of the ICJ. In the report, as you know, the court noted with appreciation that in its resolution 68/116, the General Assembly called upon states that have not yet made a declaration recognizing the court's compulsory jurisdiction to consider doing so. And Romania is indeed considering joining the ranks of the countries who already did this. That is why the authorities have taken several steps in this regard. At the initiative of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Romania, a public debate was launched last year concerning the possibility of accepting this compulsory jurisdiction, and this public discussion generally showed support for the initiative, an approach shared by the Romanian authorities, the experts in the field of international law, but also by the general public. Following the conclusion of the public debate, a draft law on filing a declaration accepting this compulsory jurisdiction was submitted to one of the chambers of the parliament and is currently examined by the other chamber, the Senate. So, thus, there is a good chance that at the time of the delivery of the next annual report, Romania will already be among the states accepting the compulsory jurisdiction of the ICJ, which is, of course, a further proof of our strong support. Mr. President, let me finally reiterate Romania's firm belief that strict compliance with international law norms is a prerequisite for the proper functioning of the international society. This vision is best reflected by the words of former Romanian Foreign Minister and former President of the League of Nations, Nicolae Titulescu, inscribed beneath his effigy at the Peace Palace in The Hague. He used to say that only peace born out of legal order allows humanity to fulfill its destiny. Thank you very much.
I thank the distinguished representative of Romania, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of the Sudan.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Mr. President, Sudan joins its voice to the statement that was made by the Islamic Republic of Iran on behalf of NAM and South Africa on behalf of the African group. My delegation takes note of the Secretary General's reports on the work of the ICJ as part of document A-69-4. We would also like to thank the President of the Court, Judge Peter Tomka, for his presentation of the report, which reflects the activities and the deliberations that have been undertaken by the courts in the judicial year 2013-2014. My delegation expresses its appreciation for the role played by the courts and that it continues to undertake as part of its duties under the Charter and as part of the major judicial body of the United Nations to strengthen the rule of law internationally through judgments and opinions requested of the court that make a vital contribution to the strengthening of the peaceful settlement of disputes as well. Mr. President, the role of the ICJ and its great number of activities requires that member states provide more political support, as well as that they guarantee enough funds so that the court will be able to undertake the duties that have been assigned. The annual report is a good opportunity for the General Assembly to reaffirm the importance of the role of this court and to give it its support. The large number of trials or conflicts referred to the court shows that there is growing confidence in it and in its ability to resolve these disputes with independence and integrity and in a way that is acceptable to all of the parties to the conflict. Sudan would encourage the court to pursue measures that would strengthen capacities and the effectiveness of the courts to deal with the high and growing number of cases and responsibilities, in particular to come to a decision quickly when from a trial. My delegation would like to encourage the General Assembly and member states that have not yet recognized the jurisdiction of the court to view this in a favorable light, to take steps to contribute to strengthening the rule of law internationally, and so that the court will be able to undertake its duties in accordance with the Charter. The Security Council has not asked any advisory opinions from the court since 1970, and Sudan would ask for the Council to take this opportunity of having the court as the major judicial body of the UN and having it as a source of advisory opinions regarding the interpretation of international law. We would ask them to take advantage of this opportunity to tap into the experience. We'd ask the General Assembly and bodies of specialized agencies to ask for advisory opinions of the ICJ as well, especially having to do with the interpretation of international law on their programs and activities. Sudan reiterates the importance to be given to the court, and we give them our support for their role. Thank you.
Representative of the Sudan, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of the Philippines.
Thank you, Mr. President. At the outset, we thank President Peter Tomka and his team at The Hague for their comprehensive report on the work of the International Court of Justice in the past year. The Philippines associates itself with a statement delivered by the Islamic Republic of Iran on behalf of the Non-Aligned Movement. Since its creation 68 years ago, the court continues to play a vital role in international relations. As the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, it resolves disputes which cannot otherwise be resolved by or through the political organs of the UN. Under Article 38 of the Statute of the Court, these are disputes that are capable of settlement through the application of the sources of international law, such as treaty, international custom, general principles of law, and as subsidiary sources, judicial decisions, and the teachings of the most highly qualified publicists. Mr. President, 2 years ago, the UN held its first ever high-level meeting on the rule of law. It resulted in a consensus declaration on the rule of law at the national and international levels. That document recognizes that the international community has the institutions, the working methods, and the relationships to make the rule of law relevant to peace and security, to human rights, and to development. One of these institutions is none other than the International Court of Justice. Paragraph 31 of the Declaration recognizes the invaluable contribution of the Court in promoting the rule of law. The Philippines reaffirms its support for that declaration, and we affirm our duty to comply with the decisions of the Court in contentious cases. We are reminded of Article 1, Paragraph 1 of the UN Charter, of our peremptory duty to bring about by peaceful means and in conformity with the principles of justice and international law, adjustment or settlement of international disputes or situations which might lead to a breach of the peace. Mr. President, this is the very rationale for the 1982 Manila Declaration on the Peaceful Settlement of International Disputes, whose 30th anniversary we commemorated 2 years ago. The Manila Declaration was negotiated and adopted by the General Assembly during the Cold War, when non-aligned countries were seeking to consolidate their political and economic independence. The Manila Declaration supported their aspirations by articulating the norms of the peaceful settlement of disputes as outlined in Chapter 6 of the UN Charter. Beginning with the Corfu Channel case in 1947 until the adoption in 1982 of the Manila Declaration, or a span of 35 years, the Court had disposed of 49 contentious cases. Since 1982, however, the caseload of the Court has increased, disposing of over 80 contentious cases in a comparatively lesser period of 32 years. In the period under review, the Court was seized of 7 new contentious cases, bringing its docket to 13 cases, or actually now 14, as we just have learned from President Tomka. The sovereign parties to those cases come from all over the world, half of them from Latin America. Yesterday, at an event co-organized by Mexico and the American Society of International Law, we gained ideas on why Latin American countries repose great trust in international adjudication, including by the Court. Thus, we learn how Latin America as a group has contributed to the progressive development of international law. It is an example that we believe the rest of the world should follow. This ever-increasing confidence, especially among developing countries, in the capabilities, credibility, and impartiality of the Court to settle disputes exclusively by peaceful means is not unrelated to the norms, values, and aspirations articulated by the 1982 Manila Declaration. The most fundamental of these is the non-use or threat of use of force. After all, the Declaration reflects the international community's increasing reliance on the rule of law as a cornerstone not only of the peaceful settlement of disputes, but also of the maintenance of international peace and security. Mr. President, only the rule of law at the international level can we guarantee the respect, order, and stability that we desire and deserve. This is how we contribute to the progressive development of international law. The mandate and jurisdiction of the Court have become sharper over the years. The creation of the International Criminal Court and specialized dispute settlement mechanisms like the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea and the appellate body of the World Trade Organization do not make the Court any less important in the 21st century. On the contrary, the contemporary international legal architecture only strengthens the Court as the only forum for resolving justiciable disputes between states concerning the vast field of general international law. As a matter of fact, the court is still seized of disputes concerning genocide, territorial and maritime issues, environmental damage, and the conservation of living resources. Mr. President, if there is anything that the UN Charter, together with the statute, jurisprudence, and experience of the International Court of Justice all teach us, it is that smaller nations, if their cause is just, should have no fear of the big powers. It is that through the work of the court, the rule of law in international relations has a chance to prevail. The Philippines therefore renews the call for member states that have not yet done so to accept the compulsory jurisdiction of the court. Finally, we also call on the Security Council to seriously consider Article 96 of the UN Charter and make greater use of the court as a source of advisory opinions and of interpretation of relevant norms of international law, particularly on the most current and controversial issues affecting international peace and security. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished representative of the Philippines, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Mexico.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Mr. President, the delegation of Mexico wishes to express its deep gratitude to the International Court of Justice for the arduous work that it has carried out this year. We're also grateful to its president, Judge Tomka, for presenting the report. The important and intensive work of the court over the past year is testimony to the confidence of the international community in the court as the principal judicial organ. The strength of the court lies in its universal calling, where the parties to the disputes represent all regional groups and continents. It also lies in states' use of the various procedural avenues available to them under the statute, and it also lies in the diversity of substantive matters at issue in the disputes brought before it. In this regard, my delegation wishes to underscore the fact that of the 17 cases on the list of cases heard by the court during the period covered under this review, 8 of them involve states in Latin America and the Caribbean. One of them was resolved by the court, and the other was withdrawn by the states that brought the proceedings. This is testament to the commitment that our region has to complying with international law and the principle of the peaceful settlement of international disputes. This is a total commitment. Mr. President, my delegation wishes to underscore the great judicial value of the rulings of the court, whether for states' parties in the matters themselves or for the international community as a whole, in that it serves as the primary auxiliary source of importance for determining the validity and content of norms. The court has an essential role to play in developing international law, and particularly in leading the dialogue with other adjudicatory bodies. This enriches international law and helps prevent its fragmentation. Incidentally, the work of the court has become even more complex since states repeatedly resort to all the other alternative procedural avenues available under this statute, such as the request for provisional measures and the interpretation of rulings, and the court's determination on these requests are critical to preventing an escalation or appearance of new disputes. This was clear from the case of certain activities carried out by Nicaragua in the border area and in the case involving the seizure and detention of certain documents and data, as well as an interpretation that the court made of the ruling handed down in 1962 with respect to the case involving the Temple of Priya Vihar. By the same token, and from a substantive perspective, the court in its two rulings handed down during the period covered by this report addressed very important issues such as compliance with treaty obligations with respect to the conservation of living resources, in particular in the light of the principle of good faith, as we saw in the case of whaling in the Antarctic. We also saw this in its settlement of the maritime dispute between Chile and Peru, which complements its ample jurisdiction on this issue. Mr. President, Mexico wishes to express its gratitude to the General Assembly for its willingness to authorize new positions and other budgetary requests made by the court, and we would like to call on the General Assembly to continue providing the court with the tools it needs to properly discharge its activities. And it must also provide the ICJ with the resources required for the celebration of its 70th anniversary in 2016. Mexico also wishes to express its sincere gratitude to the Registrar of the Court, Mr. Philip Couvreur, for the high-quality performance of his threefold role. And by that I mean he has to function as jurist, diplomat, and administrator. We also would like to express our appreciation to the Carnegie Endowment for housing the court in the Peace Palace in The Hague. Likewise, we would like to express our appreciation for the work carried out by Mexican judges throughout the history of the ICJ. Mr. President, I wish to close my statement by calling on those states that have not yet done so to accept the compulsory jurisdiction of the court pursuant to Article 36(2) of this statute, and thereby strengthen the rule of law in the international sphere so as to ensure that all states have access to a robust judicial mechanism for the peaceful settlement of disputes. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank the distinguished representative of Mexico. And I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Thailand.
Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor to deliver a statement on behalf of the Kingdom of Thailand on this agenda item. At the outset, I would like to thank President Tomka for his able presidency and for his thorough report on the court's activities during the past year. The court has played an active role in addressing disputes between states on diverse issues. For this reporting period, these range from judgment interpretation to maritime delimitation, from preservation of wildlife to the integrity of the environment. With such a diversity of cases, the report reflects the remarkable efforts made by the court in managing its docket efficiently and expeditiously. Mr. President, this year's report contains a case to which Thailand was a party, namely, the case concerning the request for interpretation of the judgment of 15 June 1962 in the case concerning the Temple of Priyavihear or Pratwihan in the Thai language. This case is probably the first time that the judges on the bench have interpreted a judgment in which none of them took part in the original proceedings. Yet, reading the interpretive judgment of 11th of November 2013 shows that the court took the time and made the effort to carefully and thoroughly review the records of the original proceedings. Indeed, the court underlines that the pleadings and the record of the oral proceedings in 1962 are, I quote, relevant to the interpretation of the judgment as they show what evidence was or was not before the court and how the issues before it were formulated by each party, end of quotation. Mr. President, overall, I am pleased to say that the judgment of 11th November 2013 is considered to be based on well-grounded reasoning and consistent with the court's past jurisprudence. It also gives importance to the need for both countries to hold talks. The judgment helps clarify several points of law that are crucial and thus will constitute a clearer and useful basis for future consultation or negotiation between the two parties, both for the matter decided by the court in 1962, that is, as the court puts it, sovereignty over a defined area of territory, and beyond. The judgment has also contributed in a positive manner to various aspects of the existing jurisprudence on judgment interpretation, some of which I would like to mention for the record. First, in interpreting the 1962 judgment, the court has reaffirmed that the principle of non ultra petita must be respected in the context of judgment interpretation. In other words, the court has reaffirmed that questions that were not properly submitted by the applicant to the court and therefore not decided by the court in the original proceedings cannot be subject to interpretation. Second, the court has also reaffirmed that the principle of res judicata must be respected in an interpretation proceeding, namely, points not decided with binding force in the original proceedings cannot be the subject of interpretation. Accordingly, the court has kept itself strictly within the limits of the original judgment and refrained from tackling questions the court did not decide in 1962. Third, the court considers that the scope of the res judicata of the 1962 judgment corresponds to that of the subject matter of the original proceedings, namely, and exclusively, sovereignty over the temple of Pravihan and the promontory on which it stands, and not any other issue. Mr. President, the temple interpretation case has been and remains an important issue in Thailand. The level of public awareness of the case and the high demand for information and explanation were unprecedented. During the oral proceedings and the reading of the judgment last year, the Thai public followed with huge interest and in real time the court's proceedings through live nationwide television broadcast from The Hague to Thailand with simultaneous interpretation into the Thai language. Hardly in Thai history has an official international event generated such a great deal of public interest. In the process, needless to say, the role of the International Court of Justice as a principal judicial organ of the United Nations has been underlined, better known, and understood in my country. It is our hope that the judgment will contribute to good neighborliness between Thailand and Cambodia, two countries that share a common destiny as ASEAN brothers. Mr. President, I would like to conclude my statement by expressing my appreciation to the judges and to the Registry of the International Court of Justice for their efficiency and professionalism, as well as their contribution to international justice. It has been an honor and a privilege for me to serve as agent of the Kingdom of Thailand in this case. Thank you.
I thank the distinguished representative of Thailand, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of France.
Mr. President, I would like to thank the President of the ICJ for his briefing, very instructive briefing of the report of activities for the Court for the year just ended. As emphasized by the list of cases for the Court, the claims activity of the Court has grown considerably for about 20 years, which shows both the confidence that states have in the court and the role that the court plays as the main judicial body of the United Nations in seeking peaceful settlement of disputes and strengthening the rule of law. In this respect, while judgments and orders of the court are binding upon parties because of the authority of res judicata, compliance and proper implementation by states also has something to do with the quality of the decisions of the court. Judgments and ordinances, orders of the court, can also contribute to calming political tensions and assisting states in finding a solution that other peaceful means for settling of disputes do not offer. The judgment of the court on the 11th of November 2013 in the case of a request for interpretation of the judgment of the 15th of June 1962 in the case of the Temple of Previar is an illustration of this. The judgment should help smooth over the territorial dispute between Cambodia and Thailand and allow them to find a solution regarding the delimitation of their common boundary in this area. Boundary disputes are an important dimension of the activity of the court, and in this category, maritime disputes for about 10 years now have taken on growing importance. I would note the case of Peru against Chile on a maritime dispute where the court gave its substantive judgment on the 27th of January 2014. But other cases still pending could also be mentioned. The case between Costa Rica and Nicaragua on the maritime delimitation in the Caribbean and the Pacific Ocean. The case between Nicaragua and Colombia on alleged violations of sovereign rights and maritime spaces in the Caribbean. And the other case between Nicaragua and Colombia on the question of delimitation of the continental shelf between Nicaragua and Colombia beyond 200 nautical miles of the coast of Nicaragua. Or the case recently filed by Somalia against Kenya on the delimitation of the common maritime boundary for these two states in the Indian Ocean. Additionally, this year was once again an opportunity to note the diverse subject matter that the court has to work in now. Among disputes given to the court, four have to do with aspects on the obligation to negotiate. The three requests of the Marshall Islands given to the court on negotiations concerning the end of the nuclear arms race and nuclear disarmament, the case of Bolivia against Chile on the obligation to negotiate access to the Pacific Ocean. The obligation to negotiate is one of the cornerstones of international public law, cross-cutting into the different areas of law. This year has also been characterized by a number of requests to the court on the basis of Article 38, para 5 of the Statute of the Courts. As part of a substantive trend, these procedures were once again specifically utilized this year by states. 12 orders for three substantive judgments. This gave the court an opportunity to specify the content of its judicial function, but it also lengthens the length of trials and it increases the workload of the court. Generally speaking, this unique remedy to the ICJ shows the quality of the underlying foundation of its judgments and the balance of its solutions. Mr. President, I would like to take this opportunity to once again say to the court on behalf of France how much we appreciate the work done by you, which once again this year shows sustained and effective activity. Thank you very much.
I thank the distinguished representative of France, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of India.
Thank you, Mr. President. We join other delegations in thanking President of the International Court of Justice, Judge Tomka, for presenting a comprehensive report covering the judicial activities of the court over the last year. The court, being the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, is entrusted with the task of peaceful resolution of disputes between states, which is important for fulfillment of one of the core purposes of the United Nations, namely the maintenance of international peace and security. Since its establishment, the court has admirably fulfilled that task and has acquired a well-deserved reputation as an impartial institution, maintaining the highest legal standards in accordance with its mandate under the Charter of the United Nations, of which the statute of the court is an integral part. Mr. President, as stated in the preamble to the Charter, one of the primary goals of the United Nations is to establish conditions under which justice and respect for international obligations can be maintained. The ICJ, as the only court with jurisdiction in general international law, is uniquely placed to fulfill that role. The report of the court, contained in document A/69/4, illustrates the importance that states attach and the confidence that the states repose in the court, as is clearly evidenced through the number, nature, and the variety of cases that the court deals with, and through the ability of the court in so dealing with the complex aspects of public international law. The cases before the court involve a wide variety of subject matters, such as territorial and maritime disputes, environmental damage and conservation of living resources, violation of territorial integrity, violation of international humanitarian law and human rights, genocide, interpretation and application of international conventions and treaties, and interpretation of court's judgments. Mr. President, the judgments delivered by the ICJ have played an important role in the interpretation and clarification of rules of international law, as well as in the progressive development and codification of international law. In the performance of its judicial functions, the court has remained sensitive to political realities and sentiments of states while acting strictly in accordance with the provisions of the UN Charter, its own statute, and other applicable rules of international law. Mr. President, the acceptance of compulsory jurisdiction of the court is a means to secure and promote peaceful settlement of disputes. Its foundation lies in the confidence expressed by states in the rule of law at the international level. States who have reposed faith in this system under Article 36(2) of the statute do so for legal disputes that may arise between the parties inter se. This is confirmed by Article 59 of the statute, which clearly provides that the decision of the court has no binding force except between the parties and in respect of that particular case. Therefore, filing of cases that seek universal objectives in complete disregard of this basic premise raises very serious issues for countries like India that have accepted compulsory jurisdiction of the court. As regards the court's docket, we note that during the 2013 to 2014 judicial year, the court delivered 3 judgments, held public hearings in 4 cases, and also handed down 13 orders. The court during this period was seized of 7 new contentious cases. The total number of contentious cases presently before the court, as clarified by President Tom Kha, now stands at 14. Mr. President, the court's second function of providing advisory opinion on legal questions referred to it by organs of the United Nations and specialized agencies adds to its important role of clarifying key international legal issues. The report of the court rightly points out that everything the court does is aimed at promoting the rule of law, in particularly through its judgments and the advisory opinions. We appreciate the court's efforts to ensure the greatest possible global awareness of its decisions through its publications, multimedia offerings, and the website, which now feature the court's entire jurisprudence as well as that of its predecessor, the Permanent Court of International Justice. Mr. President, we are glad to note that the court is planning to celebrate its 70th anniversary in April 2016 and is organizing a number of events on that occasion. Finally, Mr. President, India wishes to reaffirm its support to the court and acknowledges the importance that the international community attaches to the work of the court in the advancement of international justice. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished representative of India, and I now give the floor to the distinguished representative of Peru.
Gracias, señor presidente.
Thank you, Mr. President. Peru was pleased to receive the annual report of the International Court of Justice here in the General Assembly, which gives an account of its work between the 1st of August 2013 and 31st of July 2014. My delegation wishes to begin our statement by underscoring the critical role played by the International Court of Justice as the principal judicial organ of the United Nations in the system for the peaceful settlement of disputes in the under the Charter. Its contribution to promoting the rule of law has been vital. Peru also wishes to recall that in addition to the useful work of the court in the peaceful settlement of interstate disputes, the court may, pursuant to Article 96 of the Charter, issue advisory opinions at the request of the General Assembly, the Security Council, and other authorized bodies of the United Nations and specialized agencies. These are two areas of jurisdiction of the court: jurisdiction in contentious proceedings and advisory jurisdiction. And the ICJ's judgments and opinions help promote and clarify international law as a genuine path to peace. Peru is pleased that the General Assembly has encouraged states that have not yet done so to consider recognizing the jurisdiction of the court pursuant to Article 36, paragraph 2 of its statute. Peru also wishes to recognize the work carried out by the distinguished judges of the court, in particular the president and vice president, as well as the judges ad hoc. And Peru welcomes the forthcoming triennial renewal of the composition of the court through elections slated for the 6th of November. Likewise, we wish to state for the record that we are grateful for the intense work carried out by the registry of the court, and in particular by its registrar and deputy registrar. Mr. President, the constant high volume of work at the International Court of Justice is testament to the prestige it enjoys as the principal judicial organ of the United Nations. And this is explained inter alia by the high number of measures taken over the past few years to enhance its efficiency and enable it to cope with a constant increase in its workload and to more promptly deal with the growing number of incidental proceedings, as we can see in paragraphs 9 and 10 of the report. Likewise, Peru is pleased to note that in the biennium 2014 to 2015, most of the requests for new positions and more expenditure entered by the court were granted. My delegation hopes to see the same spirit reign in the 2016-2017 biennium, when we will celebrate the 70th anniversary of the court. And in closing, as stated by the President of the Republic of Peru, Ollanta Humala Tasio, at the opening of this session of the GA, my delegation wishes to highlight the settlement of the maritime border dispute with Chile through the judgment of the ICJ, which was handed down on the 27th of January 2014. And by the same token, we heard the president of the court touch on this during his statement. By the same token, we also wish to underscore that the enforcement of the judgment was the quickest in the history of the court, as both parties jointly pinpointed the geographic coordinates of the maritime border, and this was done in accordance with the judgment within 2 months of the ruling. And it is for this reason that the president of Peru was able to say, in general, the manner in which the entire proceedings were conducted is an example for Peru and Chile, and indeed for the world. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished representative of Peru, and now I give the floor to the distinguished representative of Japan.
Mr.
Mr. President of the General Assembly, Mr. President of the International Court of Justice, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen. At the outset, I would like to thank President Peter Tonka, President of the International Court of Justice, for his leadership, as well as for his comprehensive report on the work of the court. As Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan emphasized at this podium 2 years in a row, the rule of law is one of the most important aspects of Japan's foreign policy. Japan attaches particular importance to the activities of the ICJ, the principal judicial organ enshrined in the UN Charter. I appreciate the role it has played to enhance the rule of law in the international community. Mr. President, international law provides parties concerned with a common language. We hear mounting expectations across the globe for international law to serve as a device to disentangle the tensions of heated controversies. Cases referred to the court involve a wide variety of subject matters, including territorial and maritime disputes, economic and environmental disputes, and violation related to international humanitarian and human rights law. Despite the fact that the court has been dealing with more complex cases in factual and legal terms, I appreciate that the court maintains its high-quality work. Mr. President, Japan strongly believes that more and more countries concerned should recognize the importance of international law and make good use of the ICJ. For example, universal acceptance of the court's jurisdiction in accordance with Article 36, paragraph 2 of the ICJ statute would enhance the function of the court. Japan already in 1958 unilaterally accepted the compulsory jurisdiction of the ICJ. The situation concerning the acceptance of the jurisdiction of the court is, however, very poor. Only 70 out of the entire membership of the United Nations have accepted the compulsory jurisdiction of the ICJ. Looking at the Asia-Pacific group, which Japan belongs to, only 7 out of 54 countries have accepted it. I hope to see more countries, in particular members of the Asia-Pacific group, do so. In this context, Japan highly values the recent publication of the Handbook on Accepting the Jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice, whose copy I have it with me. Let me express my special gratitude to Switzerland for their leadership to compile this handbook. My appreciation also goes to the other co-sponsors, namely the Netherlands, Uruguay, the United Kingdom, Lithuania, and Botswana. Japan is proud to be among 7 co-producers. Mr. President, I would also like to take this opportunity to refer to Japan's experience in the peaceful settlement of disputes in the ICJ. It was an important year for Japan as the court delivered its judgment in the case concerning whaling in the Antarctic. Throughout the proceedings before the court, Japan has made clear its position on the issues involved in the case in full respect of the procedures. The decision that Japan's whaling research program did not fall within the relevant article of the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling was disappointing. However, Japan abides by the judgment of the court. Japan will continue to pursue its policy on the sustainable use of marine living resources in accordance with international law and based upon scientific evidence, taking into account the reasoning and conclusions contained in the judgment. Finally, Mr. President, I wish to reiterate Japan's unwavering support for the International Court of Justice. I thank you very much.
I thank the distinguished representative of Japan. We have heard the last speaker in the debate on this meeting. We shall hear the remaining speakers this afternoon at 3 p.m. in this hall. The meeting is adjourned.